This podcast is sponsored by Cellar Plan from Berry Brothers and Rudd, collecting fine wines for future drinking.
Hello and welcome to the Spectator podcast. I'm Lara Prendergast, and on this week's episode, we'll be looking at the aid industry in crisis. We'll also be debating how to tackle knife crime, and finally, we'll be discussing and trying booze-free booze. First up, in this week's issue, Harriet Sargent suggests that the Oxfam revelations threaten to extinguish the virtuous glow that has protected the aid industry from scrutiny. I'm now joined by Jonathan Foreman, a senior research fellow at Civitas and author of Aiding and Abetting, and Deborah Doane, who's worked in the international development sector for 20 years, to discuss. So Deborah, does it seem to you like this Oxfam story is a one-off, or do you think this is just the start of a kind of Me Too moment for the charity sector?
I definitely think this is a Me Too moment for the sector, and it's probably been a long time coming. And lots of stories are now coming out of the woodwork. It's not confined to one organization or one sector. You know, there's a lot of, there's private sector involved in the aid business. There's the UN sector. It's probably systemic.
Jonathan, did the Oxfam story come as a surprise to you?
I didn't know these particular details, so in that sense it came as a surprise. But the idea of exploitation and very bad behaviour being covered up didn't come as a surprise to me at all. And that's because, as you know, someone who's been studying the aid industry for a while and who's also dealt with Oxfam quite a lot. I mean, there's a long-term pattern of sort of secretiveness and impunity. I mean, I was shocked, I have to say, by the actual revelations. I mean, it is pretty, I mean, I've seen some bad behaviour and, you know, like everyone else, I read Linda Pullman's brilliant book, War Games, and so I knew that there's prostitution that pops up in conflict zones and in disaster areas that pops up, especially when the sort of aid circus turns up. So I knew about that, but the idea of that a senior person would have preyed on underage girls in more than one place and someone that senior and got away with it, that, I have to say, did shock me. Because that is, it's not surprising that bad things happen in these areas in the sense that you've got terrible human desperation meeting human moral weakness, but it's still shocking.
It's not just moral weakness, it's power.
Yes.
Right? People who come in with a lot of resources, I think in many cases, probably most cases, wanting to help are in positions of power. And quite often it's men in those positions of power. And I think that generates conditions for problems to arise. That doesn't mean, I agree with you, these were shocking revelations.
I mean, unfortunately, Oxfam, more than any other aid agency I've dealt with, has a sort of weird culture, strangely like that of the Catholic Church, as it was, in the sense that it's infallible. Oxfam has never admitted to making a mistake ever, as far as I could tell, of any kind in its entire history. No methodologies didn't work, no projects failed. You know, they've just never done it. And it comes out of a sort of, and a lot of aid agencies like this, the sort of marketing-driven approach to aid, in which, you know, our priority is to raise money for people. If we admit that aid is a difficult thing to do, that it's fraught with difficult moral questions, that aid delivery is actually very hard to do well, then people aren't going to pay us so much. We'll just, you know, our line is going to be, it's simple, aid is easy, just give us your money and don't worry your little heads about how it's going to work out in the end. And the problem is that attitude actually damages their internal workings too, because you get end up with, no one wants to admit making mistakes. You know, lying sort of spreads down. It's also to do with the other thing that I think I've often encountered is there's a lot of wild behaviour that you encounter if you go to areas where people do, you know, the really bad
progresses.
On the ground, there's bad behaviour. I mean, look, people blow off steam. It's difficult. It's dangerous work very often. And people are going to, you know, there's a lot of drinking. There's a lot of drugs. There's a lot of sex. That's part of the fun of aid
work. These are the same arguments that people were talking about in Hollywood. But yeah, people seem sort of more...
Yes, except there's more... I mean, it's slightly more justifiable. But it can spill over. And one of the strange things about aid is because people are sort of on the side of the angels, because people feel, look, I could be at home making good money, but I'm not. I'm out here helping people. I'm one of the good people. It's like you've ticked your goodness box, which then frees you to sort of behave badly. And I've seen a lot of terrible behaviour internally, exploitation, bullying, very bad treatment of local hires. You know, these people have a very high status in the world that they're in. They have more money than the people they work among. And there's a kind of slightly imperial, colonial feel. I mean, in fact, you could argue that the whole industry is a kind of imperial industry. I mean, it's a bunch of mostly white people turning up in poor countries, helping people, just like people, the missionaries did 100 years ago. And they do help people, but there's also a kind of arrogance involved in that.
I mean, I've written about the arrogance, and I don't want to be in a position of defending that. I do think there are some good things that the not-for-profit sector, aid agencies do, and I don't think we should ignore those. You know, the humanitarian system, sometimes you might want to separate
humanitarian from development,
because actually they're very different. I think Oxfam, some of the other agencies have done some amazing things in campaigns, in their inequality campaigning.
See, that's why I think that's one of the problems, actually, is this sort of weird mixture. I mean, because the marketing is all, look, we're saving lives, give us your money. But actually, a lot of it isn't saving lives. A lot of it is, especially in Oxfam's case, which is, you know, very close to the Labour Party, very political. And the money you give that you think is going to be used to sort of feed the starving is actually going to be used for campaigns for higher taxes or whatever it is.
But those campaigns are actually what ultimately will lead to more long-term reform so that you don't have to keep giving charity.
Possibly. I mean, that's what they would argue. Yes.
Well, and that's what I would argue.
Yeah.
Jonathan, where would you say the main problem? Is it at the top of charities where the reform needs to happen, or is it on the ground that the reform needs to happen?
In my experience, it depends on the charity, I think. I think some of them are institutionally sort of corrupted organisations. On the other hand, I mean, you'd go to, say, Save the Children, which has had problems in the past, there's no question, and actually has been mentioned in this current Me Too moment as of having done the same things. I mean, and it has some other black marks in the past. I mean, in Michael Maron's book, he talks about in the Ethiopian famine how Save the Children International actually ended up helping the regime forcibly remove people from villages, supplying them with trucks. It's the kind of compromise that gets made a lot in aid world. You know, you end up basically supporting one side or another in a war in order so you can do your work. But Save the Children, in my experience, listens to criticism. They bring in outsiders, people like me who come in, and they do try and, certainly below a certain level, are willing to admit mistakes and are keen on openness. I think the younger generation and people of aid tend to be like that. I don't think Oxfam's like that. And I think it's one of the reasons why this has happened. And it's very sad because, as you say, Oxfam has done very good work. They've got brilliant expertise in things, especially like water and a few other things. I mean, they do some very good work. But I don't know. I think part of the problem is that is the sort of marketing. Oxfam's marketing is rightly controversial. The way that Africa,
quite frankly, Save the Children's is as well. Yes. You know, if you're homesick during the day and you turn on the television, there's a lovely commercial from Save the Children with a starving black baby.
With a white nurse. Is there a white nurse?
Oxfam doesn't do that. I don't want to get into pitting one organization against the other. I think it's more productive to talk about how the sector needs to change and can it change. I think that's a little bit more useful than targeting the culture of one organization over another, because those cultures exist, I think, across the sector.
Yes, well, yeah, I think the whole industry perhaps is a problem.
Mary Wakefield also writes a piece in this week's issue, and she suggests that we're sort of more reluctant to kind of criticise places like Oxfam and that we're more comfortable criticising institutions like Hollywood. Do you think that's fair?
Of course that's fair, and justifiably fair. I mean, our heart wants to give. And even if you look at, people are concerned about, we spend so much money on aid, it's actually not that much money. And you think of the sea of need that there is out there, people want to be able to do something. And they like to think that their money is doing good things. And I think in many cases, their money is doing good things, whether it's their direct giving or money coming from the government via our taxes. So nobody wants to assume they're doing harm, which is why we are going to be light touch. Whereas if you think about a commercial entity like the film industry, it doesn't necessarily have that sense of doing good in the world. I don't think we should underestimate the good that can be done if certain things change. What I'm afraid of is that this whole debate is being used as a reason to say, actually, we should cut all aid. We've got to help people at home. Why bother helping people abroad? I think we have to look differently about how we help people abroad, what these agencies can do as part of the kind of ecosystem that does that. Looking at local organizations is really important, thinking beyond the big charities and the big brands, to actually, how do we genuinely help people who are in need in poorer countries?
It's interesting that you say that. I mean, about especially the big charities. You know, I'm a trustee of an NGO myself, and I've got lots of friends in the NGO sector, and I've had friends who run some very effective small organizations in South Asia, all of whom tried to get money from DFID, the Department for International Development, but they were too small. Okay. They're not interested in doing it. If you're not asking for millions, they don't want you.
And that's one of the fundamental problems, is, you know, I pulled out one estimate. 2% of humanitarian aid goes to local organizations on the ground. And actually, it's those local organizations in a humanitarian crisis that do the best work. The Ebola crisis was all local organizations who actually did that work. There was some support from some of the larger aid agencies.
Yeah, I mean, MSF did amazing work.
Exactly. Yeah. But the bulk of the work was actually done by grassroots organizations. How do we get more money to them? How do we better equip them to deal with those disasters? And I guess the question is, what is the role of the big charities in enabling that?
My impression is that sort of one of the problems is that in the marketing, done by the aid industry, the problem is always lack of money. The problem is not lack of money. It's sloshing money. Money's just, there's so much money, people don't know what to do with it. And there are reporting requirements that are necessary because people want to know the money that's not being wasted. On the other hand, those reporting requirements are impossible to do if you're a small organisation. So it's all very difficult. And I think the thing that the aid industry needs to be more honest about and that the public needs to understand is that, you know, aid is very difficult. It often doesn't work. It sometimes gets things wrong. The whole idea of doing no harm doesn't get nearly enough airing in the industry itself, because if you do criticise anything, or if anyone says, oh, you just want children to die, I've had that said to me 100 times. I've had it once. Every time you mention anything that's gone wrong, you're just trying to stop people from giving us money so we can save lives. And this whole saving lives thing, David Cameron used to go on about it endlessly when he was defending the 0.7% requirement. It's like, what's about saving lives? Well, it's not. A very small percentage of British aid goes into humanitarian and emergency aid. Most of it goes into development aid, all of which is a very dubious experiment.
No, but development aid, in theory, should be actually being preventative. You spend more money up front. If you think about something like climate change, you're going to be dealing with disaster after disaster. And if we don't, you know, put up some flood barriers and try and stem some of those problems before happen.
It's jolly convenient that climate change crisis come along after 70 years of official development aid and $3 trillion with a very dubious effect. It's employed a lot of people, a lot of white middle class people who get to go out in their endless gap year after they leave England and live a lovely life in Africa or South Asia. But has it actually made any difference to actual development? Has it helped people except in that NGO sector? Or has it... ensure that Mugabe and people like that could stay in power.
So that makes... Okay, giant leap to Mugabe staying in power.
But it is. He's a beneficiary of development aid and food aid to Zimbabwe. Without that regime, there would have been a revolution years ago.
In her piece, Harriet suggests that charities end up doing more harm than good. Do you think that's fair?
No, I don't think that's fair. I think large charities can cause harm in some cases, but I think on balance they do more good than harm. What I do think, though, I am very much of the view that we do need to think more locally, and some of the charities have become very large and too powerful. And I think your point is valid about acknowledging the complexity of aid, acknowledging the difficulty of delivering aid in really tough circumstances, and that actually, you're right, bringing people along this journey that, don't worry, your £5 a month will solve poverty is ridiculous.
Yeah.
Because actually, poverty is complex, poverty is political. In a lot of cases, charities can't be overly political because of charity regulation. So let's not overpromise that what your money is giving is actually going to solve the problem. But that still, for me, isn't a reason to stop giving, because I think there's a lot of opportunity if the sector is willing to really look at itself and its role in this, then actually it can shift.
And thank you for saying that. I mean, I think that's true. I mean, I think it's not just a technical problem in terms of how we help people in terms of aid. It's not just hard to do. It's not just difficult to do. It's also fraught with very difficult moral and political questions. I mean, when you are in that war zone and the militia could turn up and say, if you want to work here, you're going to have to give us radios, you're going to have to give us water, you're going to have to give us food. What do you do? It's a very difficult question. If you're MSF, which broke with the aid industry in many ways, you say, forget it, we're pulling out. We're not going to get involved because we know that if we don't, we're going to keep this war going, so that we're actually going to make more people will die if we pay that ransom. And that has happened a great deal.
These questions have been happening. So I started in the sector over 20 years ago, setting up an international ombudsman for humanitarian aid to deal with some of these really difficult questions. It morphed into a sort of standard for the aid sector rather than a genuine accountability mechanism. But it was asking those very difficult questions. If in saving one person, do you cause harm to 10 others? Yeah. What is your role as a humanitarian? It's a very difficult moral question.
Yes.
Thank you, Deborah, and thank you, Jonathan.
What are you drinking this weekend? Start a cellar plan with Berry Brothers and Rudd, and soon you could be uncorking something out of the ordinary. To start your cellar collection, visit bbr.com/cellar plan.
In this week's issue, Munira Mirza, the former Deputy Mayor of London for Education and Culture, writes about knife crime. According to the latest recorded crime figures in England and Wales, there has been a steep rise in violent crime. Knife crime offences are up by 21% in the year to September 2017, and in London alone, the rise is 30.2%. Munira joins me now, along with Sean Bailey, a member of the London Assembly, who has recently published a report on knife crime in London. So, Minerva, what do you think is behind the rise?
I'm sure there are many different reasons, and there's a huge amount of concern in political circles and in the media. I think one thing that hasn't really been talked about enough is the fact that stop and search as a tactic has been reduced dramatically in England and Wales, and also in Scotland, which is something I talk about in the article. And whilst it's not the only factor, I think it's quite a significant one, and for various political reasons, which I explain in the article, I think a lot of people are reluctant to talk about it. I think that that's a concern, because law enforcement, policing, and how the police engage with this issue is really crucial to dealing with it.
Sean, do you think that stop and search could possibly be brought back in as a solution to this?
So, depending on where you live and which, you know, which part of our two tales of London you live in, stop and search hasn't been reduced. So the communities that faced knife crime the most, both of victims and perpetrators, their level of stop and search has been roughly the same. The rise in crime in general, particularly violent crime, isn't confined to one community. It's across the board. We have more domestic violence. We have more violent robberies and the like. And particularly for young people, there's been a change in the culture, the way in which they negotiate, the way in which they talk to each other, the way in which they respond in what is seen as a cool fashion. And of course, the real thing about knife crime, for Londoners in particular, many of the young people involved now have no criminal record, had no police contact beforehand, and carry a knife because they say it makes them feel safe. So that's really pushing it from behind.
No, you mentioned earlier the Scotland example, and which campaigners claim have had more success. What is the Scottish model?
So in Scotland, a unit was set up, the Violence Reduction Unit, to try and tackle violent crime and introduce a range of measures. A lot of people today are talking about Scotland in terms of its public health approach, so trying to bring together different agencies, health, education, police, looking at ways of alternative pathways for young people. A huge amount of work done, which is holistic. But I think what's missing in the discussion today is the fact that the police also increased stop and search quite dramatically over the last 10 years. And I would argue that that probably did have an effect. Certainly, it's one worth considering, but one that nobody wants to talk about. And I think that there is a political distaste for talking about stop and search, because it has been criticised in the past. And I completely understand, you know, I have a liberal outlook, I would say, and I understand the concerns about the use of the tactic. But in Scotland, it did have an effect. And what's happened, interestingly, in Scotland in the last 2 years, that there has been a campaign in Scotland to reduce stop and search there. And in that period where it's been reduced by around 90%, knife crime and violent crime has crept up again. Now, in Scotland, it's a very different kind of context. There isn't the same race relations issue. These are young white men being stopped, and trust relations between community and police are very different. There's a higher degree of trust, I would say. So it is a different context, but that, in a sense, is quite telling that you don't have the same political concern, and stop and search was used. I think there is a really interesting discussion about whether it was used excessively in the past, whether it could have been reduced. You know, I think that probably is the case. But the level of stop and search that's being used now is far lower than it was in 2000, far lower than it was in 2008. And Sean knows that in the last 8 years, in the 8 years between 2008 and 2016, knife crime did come down in London, and a large part of that was policing and law enforcement, as well as all the other holistic aspects.
Yeah, but so let's get this straight. I'm in favour of stop and search, absolutely. Our even black community in favour of stop and search, because at the end of the day, it sends particular messages and it does find things. The point is, the stop and search that's being talked about here is clumsy, ineffective, and in some cases drives knife crime. Because if you speak to young people particularly, a lot of them won't speak about what's happened in knife crime. So what's really happened is, if you look at detections and convictions, they have plummeted, even though the stop and search in that particular community has been kept at a relatively high level. And that's because there's no relationship with the police. And when you speak to young people, they'll talk about the fact that they're stopped and searched all the time for drugs, an offence which they're half as likely to commit as their white counterparts, but 10 times more likely to be stopped for. And why that statistic is important, because it drives a wedge between the very group of people the police need to be involved with to cut knife crime and all violent crime, and technically all crime, because it's about information. So while you talk about stop and search, absolutely for it, but what type of stop and search, where, when and who for? And when you speak to communities and say, we're going to do massive stop and search, they'll say, great, are you looking for knives? When you say no, that's when your problems start.
I think the statistics are presented in a particular way and they don't tell the whole story. So there is a statistic in the British Crime Survey that black people are less likely to use drugs, but the evidence suggests that there is a higher likelihood that black people will be arrested for possession with intent to supply.
Well, of course, because they're stopped what police far are, more. And let's get this straight. This isn't about...
If I just finish, Sean, I think that there are different traits between different communities. I completely agree that violent crime isn't just down to one community, and we have to guard against any stereotypes that suggest that, you know, the majority of black people are involved in crime. That's clearly not the case, and this is still a minority of people we're talking about in all communities. There is an interesting fact. When stop and search was reduced in London, the actual disproportional rate of stop and search amongst black people actually increased. The more targeted intelligence-led approach that everybody called for, that Sadiq Khan called for, that Theresa May called for, actually led to a higher rate of stop and search amongst black people. Fewer black people being stopped, and it is true across the board, fewer black people and white people being stopped, but the rate of being stopped was quite high. So there are two things I would say about this discussion. The first is the way that the narrative is presented, that police are targeting young black boys in particular because they have it in for them, I think is really unhelpful. I think the second thing is just that there is a misunderstanding of the statistics and the way in which statistics are used in this discussion to reinforce an argument rather than trying to have a discussion about the choices that we make as a society. I think there is a choice to be made about whether we want more stop and search in order to reduce crime, or whether we could live with more crime but less stop and search. That's a dilemma should be entitled to make, but I think the discussion makes it very difficult for us to have that honest conversation.
I'll tell you where that argument is weak for me. Firstly, you are talking about a thing that affects us all. So crime, particularly knife crime, affects us all. But stop and search affects the black community. You yourself said when there was a reduction in overall numbers, the black community faced a greater focusing on them. Profiling is how many activists.
Well, a higher rate, but fewer searches overall.
But the point is, on the ground, people who deliver this and do all day long, one of the privileges of being a London Assembly member and being a youth worker, I spend my time in these communities. I come from these communities. The rate is important because what happens is young people look at their stop and search relative to their friendship group. So they're seeing that they're being stopped at an even higher rate. And why all of these conversations are important, because they drive the perception that we don't have a police service, that we have a police force. And why we need to have a service, our whole policing model is set up on consent. It's set up that we do this together. And what we're doing is preventing people from being part of that solution. And when you talk about making London safe, I don't want to make the perception safe, because you see lots of police stopping lots of people. I want to make the actual figures go down. And the way to do that is to drive up detections and prosecutions. And the way you do that is by having a targeted, proper, proportional stop and search. Remember, I'm not talking more about a reduction. I could even stand an increase, but how is that going to be done? Where is it going to be done? The police have the most effect when they come into communities and say, we're looking for knives at this high rate, and they go for it when they do Section 60s and the like, and they get support on that. When you talk about the Glasgow model, there is significant things different about that model. So the good parts is this. It's a holistic approach, so they're looking at what the drivers are, not just the endpoint by parachuting stop and search on top of people. But also, the other end of that conversation, why the holistic approach is important in London, is because we have a far more diverse community and just multiples more people to deal with. If we have a police force that's perceived as being dropped on people, not only do you use the confidence of the black community, you then slowly lose the confidence of the young community, and then you use confidence of the wider community because no change is being made in the numbers of people who are being stopped.
I think that it's important to understand why there's disproportionality and to recognise that a lot of it's to do with the available population on the streets in the evening in a place like London. It tends to be younger profile, tends to be more black and ethnic minority people. So that explains a large part of the disproportionality. You generally don't stop and search older white women, you know, 60-year-old white women on the streets of East London. So that's one of the factors that's important to recognise. And there are questions about the drug trade in London. There are people, young people, being used as mules to carry drugs, which is something that the police have to target. I think we'd recognise that that's important. I think that in all this discussion, the assumption is often made that the police are targeting people and profiling based on stereotype rather than intelligence. But what we've seen in the last few years is that the stop and search rate has reduced for all communities. That intelligence-led approach has led to a greater disproportionality. So that is, a moral choice that we make as a society. Is it more important to make the rates equal between groups, even if that means that you are not enforcing the law in certain areas of London where there is a higher rate of black and ethnic minority people?
Hold on a second.
That affects black and ethnic minority communities. And I've met, as you have, Sean, and I know that you care passionately about this issue, so I don't doubt your integrity in making these arguments, but we know, having met victims and families of victims of knife crime, that they are actually very sympathetic in many ways to what the police are trying to do. And they themselves, and people like Richard Taylor, have argued that you need stop and search, and that there's a kind of hostility to it in the narrative out there.
There's no hostility to it from me. I know about these things. I grew up in this community. I've worked with these communities tirelessly. They do not support stop and search that is randomly forced upon their young children, because what it does is affects their mental health. It makes them grow up feeling they're the baddie, and it makes them grow up feeling they can't be part of the country. You yourself have just said that what is the available population, and in your last statement you made lots of assumptions that would signal that it's only black children who should be stopped.
No, I've never suggested that.
That's the line that comes from what you're saying, and the reason that's
important, that isn't the logical conclusion at all, it's actually the opposite.
I would reiterate the reason that is important, because if you look at the pure justice of this, if you're sat at home now and you're a red-blooded Tory and you think that we have a justice system, well, let's look at the justice of this for a second. You're stopping people because they're available to you. You have no increased intelligence that they have done a thing. You may have a stat behind it that says they're more likely to do a thing, but remember, a big part of that stat is generated by the activities of us and the police, as opposed to that particular group of people. That is very important, because it frames the life chances of people in London. It frames the life chances of someone saying to themselves, how can I be part of the wider general sort of being what it is to be British, when they've placed this on me and I have done nothing. And when you talk about community supporting stop and search, absolutely they do, because their children disproportionately die, and it is life and death. But what they're asking for is not a return to the old, aimless, targetless stop and search that we've had before. What they're asking for is the police to use the intelligence they have properly, and they're asking to be informed so they can help the police. Just returning to stop and search is an immoral, inaccurate use of police power.
But the overall reduction amongst all communities has taken place in the last few years, and I think you have to explain why it is that knife crime has spiked in the last 3 years at the same time that stop and search has been reduced dramatically across England and Wales, and the same story has happened in Scotland. I would suggest that's a correlation that's worth considering.
Thanks, Manera. Thanks, Sean.
Hello, I'm Sam Leith, literary editor of The Spectator, and I'd like to make you aware of a brand new subscription offer we've got going for anyone who admires the great writer Steven Pinker. For just £12, you can subscribe to The Spectator for 3 months, receive a copy of Mr. Pinker's new book, Enlightenment Now, The Case for Reason, Science, Humanism and Progress, and tickets to see him in discussion with me, Sam Leith, at a special Spectator event this February.
Finally, on to abstinence. In the next issue of Spectator Life, out next week, Freddie Gray, our deputy editor, tries out various alcohol-free drinks to see if he can be convinced. Freddie joins me now, along with the writer Henry Jeffries, author of Empire of Booze, to discuss the booze-free revolution and try out some of these drinks. So, Freddie, it's Ash Wednesday, Lent begins today. Were you convinced by these alcohol-free options?
No, not at all. I'm going to go absolutist about this and say that they are all disgusting. I haven't tried them all, but I'm willing to guess that they are all disgusting based on my tasting of about 10 to 15 of them, which I found so hideous and revolting. It's really put me very strongly against low or no alcohol drinks, and I just don't understand why people can't, if they don't want to drink, there are plenty of good alternatives to drink. I don't really understand the reason for drinking non-alcoholic, supposedly alcoholic drinks.
Anyway, in Freddie's piece he says that, you know, these alcoholic-free drinks are becoming much more popular. Why do you think that is?
I suppose people are looking for an alternative to alcohol, and, you know, people are drinking less. So we you know, we hear a lot about people drinking less. I think there might be an element of sort of media. It's a good story. People are drinking less, and then people give up drink for January, whether they are actually drinking a lot less. I think young people probably are drinking a lot less, but then they don't really need fake alcoholic drinks, do they? Because they've got Coca-Cola and...
And that's what you hear from all the people in the alcohol industry, that millennials don't drink, so we're changing the market to suit them.
And one of them you tried, Freddie, was Seedlip, which is £25 a bottle, I think, but it's has no tax on it. So
it's really trendy, Seedlip. A lot of people talk about it. People seem to like it.
There are lots of bars selling cocktails as well with Seedlip. Which... Yeah,
again, I don't understand why I tried it. It's really not very nice at all.
Right, should we try some?
Yes.
I think the drinks that are very nice is you can get lots of fancy tonic water, like Fever Tree, or I've got one here from Seckford. And these are, you know, designed to be drunk with gin, but on their own, squeeze of lime, dash of bitters. They are. It makes a really nice grown-up, non-alcoholic
drink. Well, let's start with that one.
Yeah, should we try this?
But then this is basically just a soft drink, then. This isn't a sort of...
Oh, no, it is. But it's a sort of grown-up soft drink, because it's got sort of bitter quinine and, you know, interesting flavours.
Are some of these alcohol-free ones, do they have the alcohol in them and then it's removed?
Yes, they use a thing called rotary evaporation, where they sort of they spin it and the alcohol comes out.
And it removes all the... Sorry. Thank you. It removes all the taste. That is really good.
Yeah, that's... I mean, you want ice, obviously, and lime.
Let's open... We've got here beer. And then let's try this 0.0%.
What's this, a Heineken?
Yeah. So, Laura, you try that first, because I've already tried it and I don't want to try it again.
May I try some of this?
I mean, it smells like beer. And it looks like beer, so it's quite convincing.
And for the first half second, it tastes like beer. And then it goes...
It just sort of disappears.
It just vanishes. And you need that redeeming alcoholic burn.
Yeah.
And without it, it's really hideous.
I can see that if you really liked alcohol but you were not trying to drink, in a pub, you could order that and you could at least sort of pretend that you're drinking. And
it's not. But actually, I'd like to ask Henry, is that just the social pressure of being seen to drink that makes people want to buy things that look like alcohol, even if they're not?
Yeah, I mean, I don't really know if there... Is there a social pressure to be seen to drink? Is there still a social pressure?
I think Nick Cohen put it quite well, that alcohol is the only drug you have to apologise for not taking.
Yeah.
And that's true in Britain. Certainly when I give up for Lent, which I've just started today, I do feel a bit... You feel a bit embarrassed just saying, no, I'm not drinking.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of teetotalers feel that.
One of my good friends went on a date recently and she sat down next to the guy and he didn't drink. And instead of ordering Fever Tree or something like that, he ordered a rooibos tea.
Right.
And she wasn't very impressed by that.
Right, but so that's not sexy then, rooibos.
I don't think rooibos tea is sexy, you know.
And the one
this is quite nice, isn't it, Nanny State?
Well, that's the one that everybody says, actually, this one's really good. But I'm afraid, again, I found it didn't do anything for me. If anything, it was really quite off-putting. And it just tastes like stale, like eating Weetabix.
Right.
It's gone off. Yeah,
and Weetabix lasts forever as well. I've never had a Weetabix that's gone off.
That's curdled
in
milk.
Oh, right. Oh, gosh.
It's
a nice colour.
The name's good. Nanny State.
Yeah, credit for the name.
Smells good. Yeah, you're right, because it needs the alcohol, brings everything together.
Yeah.
It tastes like sort of hoppy water.
Exactly.
Which isn't very nice.
Which is water that's gone off.
Right, what do you want next? Low alcohol G&T or wine?
Oh, God, this is like torture.
Should we try the wine?
I found the wine the worst of the lot.
Right. So this is Tesco's low-alcohol Garnacha Rosé. So I assume this has been de-alcoholised using scientific techniques.
The rotary technique, yes, probably.
Yeah, it's sort of pop, isn't it? It's like sort of flat pop, not in a good way.
Pop's much nicer, isn't it?
Yeah, I'd prefer Panda Cola. And then finally, the mighty gin and tonic. Is that what we're...
Yes. But so far, I think we can say we're in violent agreement that these are all disgusting.
I know, it's quite boring.
Would you rather just have a glass of water?
But I want to find who really honestly believes this stuff is good. I think people say they think it's good, but they're lying to themselves. That's my theory.
Do you think it's actually designed for alcoholics?
I said in the piece that the gin tonic, the one Henry's about to drink, is for alcoholics who miss the days when they used to throw up on themselves.
This isn't as disgusting as I thought it would be.
Oh, really?
Yeah. From your, I think, with lots of ice and lots of sort of lime juice.
It's slightly better than the diet one, I'll give you
that. Yeah, because it does have a sort of quininey taste and a junipery taste, and it is a bit cloying.
Yes.
But then sometimes gin and tonics are a bit cloying.
I did actually throw some gin in with it.
Right.
And rather than making it work, it made it even worse.
That's probably the least disgusting. This is a Tesco's low alcohol G&T, 0.5%, less than.
I think it's not quite as bad as I remember. Very, it's still bad.
I think very cold.
Yeah.
You know,
but then everything very cold, sort of all right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is a syrup so that you can make your own tonic. So you can make a kind of very weak tonic. And it's really good. it's made by a company called Jeffrey's. No relation. And I make a drink with fizzy water, ice, lime juice or grapefruit juice. And you add a splash of this.
In the tonic, would that work?
Well, it might taste a bit weird, just to sort of sweeten it and to give it a bit of bitterness. And it's lovely.
This is actually alcoholic, though?
No, not at all. No, it's basically a sugar syrup flavoured with, I think this one's flavoured with rose hip and something or other.
Yeah, it's interesting. It makes it a bit sort of floral.
Yes, it's got a sort of floral taste.
It's fine.
Laura says it's fine. Right.
I suppose you could keep a bottle of that in your bag and just put a bit in if you were.
Yeah, well, it's good for sort of making, again, kind of grown-up tasting drinks that don't have alcohol in.
I think I'd prefer elderflower, to be honest, if I was going to put something with sparkling water. So, in conclusion, are any of them convincing?
I think not. You know, I think I'm all for people not drinking. I think it's very good. People have drunk too much for too long. But I don't see why we have to simulate and drink these awful, disgusting drinks.
But especially as there's so many nice soft drinks these days.
Exactly.
You know, your Fentimans ginger beer or your Fever Trees and things like that. You know, they're quite high in sugar, actually, so you probably don't want to drink too many of them. But as a one-off drink, they are lovely and have sort of grown-up flavours.
Mm.
Thanks, Freddie. Thank you, Henry. That's all for this week. You can subscribe to the podcast on the iTunes store or by visiting spectator.co.uk/podcast. You can also subscribe to our other shows, including the Spectator Books podcast, where this week Sam Leith is speaking to the thriller writer Mick Herron. And if you enjoy the podcast, why not pick up the magazine? You can read all the features discussed, as well as great pieces by Harry Mount, Paul Wood and Bridget Keenan. We've got a special offer for podcast listeners. You can get 12 issues of The Spectator for just £12, and we'll throw in one of those coveted red Spectator notebooks. Thanks for listening, and do join us again next week.